Okay.
Okay, this was back around 1945 or 46. One of the last winters that we had a real deep snow at Meacham. The snow was somewhere between 8 and 12 feet deep on the level up there. The highway looked, where they'd plowed it back, looked like a canal. And I got called to go out on the snowplow out in La Grande on the railroad to Big Wing and plow the snow back to keep the track open. Along toward the latter part of January, we had kind of a warm-up thaw. And it was about half snow and half rain. We had plowed down to a station called Duncan, and there was a Y there, and we turned and plowed back up to Meacham or Camila. While we was there, the operator come out and said, "The train master wants you back at Meacham. That there's a snowslide has come down." Below Meacham, about a mile, is what they call a high bridge, and the track out of Meacham is on the south side of Meacham Creek, and this high bridge crosses over and puts the track on the north side of Meacham Creek, and this slide was about a mile below Meacham. The train master's name was Howard Burnett, and it was when he first was promoted to train master, and He was a good official. He wasn't, he never hurt anybody, but he was, he got eager to see this snow slide. And we took turns on the caboose, or crew. One brakeman had put on his warm clothes and wet clothes and be outside, and the others would ride in the caboose for about an hour or so, and then we'd trade back and forth. And it was my turn, and I had been working outside throwing switches and stuff. So I rode the rear end of the caboose back down, and we backed down the hill from Meacham to we hit this snowslide. It's in the night, probably around 10, 11 o'clock at night. And we didn't see it till we were right into it. When I stopped the snowplow, Howard jumped off the caboose and he started. I told him, I said, "Look out! There might be a hole in that snow." And he went up over the top of that, started over that slide, and he had a flashlight. I saw his flashlight disappear. So I followed his tracks up, and I had gone probably 8 or 10 feet up on the slide, and I saw the reflection of his flashlight down in the snow. Well, I couldn't quite reach him, and I mashed the snow down and dug it back with my hand till I got a hold of his hand and pulled him out of the snow. His glasses was full of snow, and he could hardly see, and I got him out and got him in the caboose, and he said, "By golly, Vern, that was worse than I thought." He said, "You saved my life. I thought I was done for. If you hadn't followed me, I would have been there when they plowed the snow out." It went on several times down through the years, and it didn't make any difference where along the railroad where I run into Howard Burnett. He was always come over, shook hands with me, and passed the time of day. His wife and my wife at that time had worked as telegraphers, and they were friends. And the last time I saw Howard was when I was on passenger out of Portland. And he had gone up the ladder, the official ladder, to vice president of operations out of Omaha. Had his own private car, his own chef, waiter, and really traveled in a luxurious style. The train pulled in, we had to identify it there in Portland because the dispatcher would give it right over us. And so we had to be there to identify it. Well, when I got down to Union Station from where we went to work, here was officials. I never saw so many officials around. And they was all walking around just stiff-legged, and so I stood there, and when the train pulled in, why, they pulled through the high shed. Station master stopped them, and they unloaded Howard and Evelyn's luggage, and they come walking up. He completely ignored all the officials, had a great big smile on his face, shook hands with me, told me how good it was to see me, and Evelyn asked about my wife and how she was. She shook hands and gave me a great big hug, and these other officials looked at me as if to say, well, what in the world's he got that we haven't got? And Howard completely ignored them.
Truly a friend for life.
Yeah. Now, this other about this little girl at Joseph, our Enterprise. Her folks bought a piece of ground about 100 yards off from the railroad track. Out there about a mile, half maybe, toward Joseph from Enterprise. They moved this house in on this foundation. And they got it set up just early in the fall, and was getting it finished, and they had a fire, and it destroyed part of their house. There was a restaurant in Elgin where we ate that had a bride doll on a punch board. So we asked this lady in the Brunswick Cafe there at Elgin how much that doll was worth. Oh, I can't sell it, she said. It's on the punch board. And we asked how much was on the punch board. Well, we punched the punch board out, and that number wasn't on there at all. The doll's number wasn't on the punch board at all. And she was quite bewildered about it, and she said, I don't know what I'm going to do. And so we talked it over. There was six of us on the crew, and we told her we'd give her $30 for the doll, and we told her why we wanted it. We went out on the day before Christmas, and then we left Joseph early Christmas morning to come back. And they had wrapped, she had wrapped this doll all up and just had it tied up beautiful when we picked it up. Well, when we got down to there where these folks lived, Dave Rose was the engineer, and I was one of the brakemen. It seemed like some of the other guys act like they were a little afraid they'd get in trouble or something doing something then. So I carried the doll out, and Dave met me, and I handed it over the fence to him and little Gail. Her name was Gail Eisenbrenner. She was somewhere between maybe four or five years old. She come across that field, snow was about 8-10 inches deep, long blonde hair waving in the wind and just running like everything. She would always wave at us when we went by at night before that. And it didn't make any difference what time of night, whether she heard that train and she was awake, we'd see a flashlight at her window. And in the morning, so she could, she'd be out on the porch and wave at us when we went by. So when we took this doll over and gave it to her, why, her mother couldn't even keep up with her, and Mrs. Eisenbrenner was behind her. She come out, the tears were streaming down her face, and she said, you guys are the most wonderful guys I ever saw in my life. She said, you have made Gail's Christmas. She lost everything she had in the fire, and if it hadn't have been for you boys getting this bright doll and giving it to her, she wouldn't have had a Christmas present. Years later, there was a girl who got on the train in Portland. She had a ticket to Enterprise, and I was talking to her, and I said, do you happen to know a girl up there by the name of Gail Eisenbrenner? Oh, she said, she's one of my best friends. How did you know her? And I told her about the doll. She said, you know, that's Gail's pride. She wouldn't part with that doll for anything in the world. So one time my wife and I was up there with the motorhome, and she worked for the Forest Service, and they set up an information bureau there by the courthouse in Enterprise. So I walked over to, I told my wife, I said, I'm going over and see which one's Gail. And I said, is one of you ladies Gail Ashenbrenner? And she said, I am. And I said, years ago when you were a little bitty girl, some guys gave you a doll for Christmas. How did you know about that doll? How? She said, I didn't know anybody else knew much about that. I said, well, Dave Rose and I were the guys that carried the doll across the field to you that morning. And I said, on Christmas morning of that year, it was in the 50s, you gave us a big hug and a peck on the face, and I said, you made our Christmas for us. She said, and you made my Christmas for me.
Yeah, at that time, she was about 40 years old, still had the doll.
Oh, yeah, that doll's her pride.
Yeah.
Then, after I quit railroading, I was working for Trindle at Baker. And he called me one Sunday about 1 o'clock, and he said, I want you to fly to Salem. He said, I got two students to go back to Salem. Well, I didn't know what he meant by students, so I went over there. And this young lady and boy, the boy was about 16, I think, and I think she was about, maybe 17, 18. They were going to the deaf and dumb school in Salem. And they, Mike said, I want you to take them to Salem. Well, Dwayne, the boy, he could say a few words, and he just kind of blasted it out. He was deaf, but as a deaf person talks, you could make out a few words, but most of the time they talked sign language. Well, the first trip I took them down, she sat in the back seat of the airplane and just acted like she didn't care whether school kept or not. And he busied himself looking out the window a little bit, and like he was thoroughly bored and thinking the trip. When I got to Salem, why, I called the school and they come and picked him up. Kids didn't say aye, yes, or no, or anything. They just left.
Well, about time to figure out what was wrong with the computer, and finally got
after. He said, Vern, I want you to make that trip to Salem again. And I had thought and thought and thought, how in the world can I make the trip so it would be more interesting for these kids going to Salem? And when I went in over there, they had both won Special Olympic medals. And Dwayne comes and says, see Vern, see Vern, and handed it to me, and I patted him on the back and gave him a high sign that, boy, that's okay. It just tickled him half to death. And so then she showed me her medal, and she'd got it in volleyball or some sport. And I said, well, Linda, you did real good, too. You're just as good as Dwayne. And I patted them both on the back and gave them a sign that everything was A-okay. Well, when it come time to leave, well, I filed my flight plan, and they got in the plane. After it took off and got the plane trimmed to climb out to cruise altitude, I thought, now if I take the sectional map and spread it out and maybe get him following our line of flight on the map, it would make the trip more interesting to him. So as you took off from Baker, well, you'd fly over the Auburn area and then till you get around on the south end of the Elkhorns and then head right straight toward John Day and down over that way to Salem, straight through to Salem. So I spread the map out, and he was sitting there, and I reached over and tapped him on the shoulder, and I took his finger and put it on the map right where we were. and I pointed down like that, and boy, his face lit up, and he pointed again, and I shook my head, and pointed off the other way. Here was Phillips Reservoir, and he saw that on the map, and he said, "See, see, see," and I'd like that to him, and wasn't no time at all till Linda was looking over her shoulder. He'd turn around and tell her in sign language what we was doing. Well, we'd come around, and then he picked up Sumter down there, and he pointed down there, and then pointed the map, and I said, like that, and boy, I just. He began to smile and act like he was enjoying the trip. We did that all the way. Dixie Mountain, Prairie City, Fox Valley, John Day, Dayville, Painted Gorge. And when we got down to where the John Day River turned toward the Columbia, out there where Roger Neese Perum was, why, he happened to see Roger Neese Perum on the map, and he pointed to it, and I pointed off over like that. He looked at it, and he said, he pointed to me, and he made the awfulest face, and he said, he didn't like them at all. We got into Salem. I called the school. They sent a car out. I helped those kids load their luggage into the car to get ready to go back to school. Both of them give me a big handshake and a big hug, and they both said, "Bye, Vern," and when they drove away, the boss was waving just to me, just as far as they could see. I told Mike about it afterwards. He said, "You know, you made that trip about halfway interesting for those kids. I never have seen them again. I don't know whatever happened to them, but that one trip, at least it, they showed an interest in what was going on and weren't bored on the flight all the way to Salem."
So there's a way to connect with them if you just work at it.
Yeah.
Well, what a wonderful story.